Hello and welcome to Locked On Vikings on this January 14th, the 1 year anniversary of the Minneapolis Miracle. I am your host. I am your pal. I'm the kid you copied off in math class. My name is Luke Braun. You can follow me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. You can follow the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings. And we have so much to cover today, so let's get right into it. The big news that happened since we last spoke involves one special teams coordinator, but first, I want to talk a little bit about some of the other relevant coaching news around the league. James Campen, the offensive line coach of the Green Bay Packers, who's been there for like 11 years, was actually interviewed by the Vikings to be their offensive line coach. This would have been super interesting. You know, I've talked about it on podcasts and stuff before, but basically what the Packers do is a technique called the hug technique. It's a wide arm technique that makes it a lot harder for defensive linemen to win in hand fighting. And the Vikings were really interested in taking that. It's you see the Packers quote unquote get away with holding all the time. This technique is like specifically designed to give you the benefits of holding without it looking enough like a hold for a ref to ever call it. And it's really, really well constructed. However, unfortunately for the Vikings, the Browns hired him as an associate head coach slash offensive line coach, which is a much better position than the Vikings ever would have gotten. That basically puts him second in line if Freddie Kitchens were to fall away, and that's a great opportunity for him. Sean Coogler, who was of the Broncos offensive line and was very highly regarded as an offensive line coach around the league, was also swept up by the Arizona Cardinals, which leaves the Vikings looking outwardly once more. They've also interviewed with Joe Philbin. We've talked about that previously, and that's still on the table, but otherwise they're going to have to look elsewhere for their offensive line coach. But on to the big news, and probably the reason that you're interested in listening to this podcast, Mike Prefer, who has been with the team as the special teams coordinator since 2011, is out. And originally this was reported and we thought the Vikings had fired him, which is something a lot of fans wanted. I would have been fine with that too. But it turns out that the Vikings actually wanted to extend his contract, which expired after the season, but the Cleveland Browns quote-unquote blew him away, and he will not be returning of his own accord, which is a much more interesting dynamic. The result is obviously the same. We're going to get a new special teams coordinator, and some people are probably going to be happy with that regardless, but it does kind of signal that the Vikings were very happy with what Prefer was offering as a special teams coordinator, and that can give us at least a hint of what they're going to look for in the next guy. They're going to look for somebody who represents continuity. Now, the easiest answer to that question is Ryan Ficken, who is currently the assistant special teams coordinator. Just promote him and tell him, hey, just do what your boss used to do and everything will be hunky-dory. But this also represents an opportunity for the Vikings. So just a little bit about their special teams. And we'll talk a little bit about Mike Prefer's legacy with the Vikings, too, because he was here for a long time. But the special teams, as of late, has taken a very conservative strategy. Marcus Sherrill's, you know, he fair catches a lot. He won't often break a huge run anymore. I mean, he's 31. He used to be a lot faster. But he will get very consistently a few yards on punt returns. So you kind of sacrifice that explosiveness that you used to have with the ability to have someone like Marcus Sherrills who will just never, ever muff a punt, right? He is just like the surest-handed guy ever. And I think a lot of people would be okay with that, myself included. I don't really have a problem with that, right? You lose games on special teams muffs, and you know, large returns are kind of gravy and a bonus. So I think it's okay to just say, hey, listen, we're just going to take the whole punt return thing and all of the crazy range of possibilities out of the game and we'll try to win on offense and defense. I think that's fine. But if you're not fine with that, and there's certainly an argument to, you know, want the Vikings special teams, especially in the punt return game, to be more aggressive and to, you know, lead to more explosive returns and explosive runs and better field position, this represents an opportunity to kind of change that philosophy. You know, put Mike Hughes back there or somebody, you know, really fast, one of those like CFL wide receivers like Terrell Singfield or whatever that, you know, you bring into camp every year. Put them back there and see if they can't make something happen. And if you end up with a muff or a fumble or something, you know, just calculate if that's worth it. Now, the Vikings, I think, have always thought, no, it is not worth it. And so I would anticipate that they stay in the same range of special teams strategy where they take things very conservatively. The other thing that they will probably look for in the newest special teams coordinator is his track record with kickers, because down the stretch, Mike Prefer was kind of blamed for a lot of the kicker woes, right? Because you had, you know, a problem with Blair Walsh and you had the extra point problem with Kai Forbath. Daniel Carlson came in and he was suddenly terrible after being this like historically good college kicker. And even Dan Bailey, who has an excellent track record in the NFL, he's like the fourth or fifth most accurate He was fourth most accurate kicker in NFL history when he came to the Vikings, and his time at the Vikings did so poorly that he actually fell in those all-time rankings. Like, it ruined the look of the rest of his career because he struggled here so much. So that through line definitely led people to believe, like, okay, Mike Prefer must be doing something to ruin kickers. You know, he also had that whole homophobia incident that really came to light in 2014 where Chris Cluey accused him of having homophobic comments. He didn't really contest that. He took a suspension from the league. And that kind of like, oh, maybe he's, you know, just an insulting kind of coach. A lot of people have worked with a coach like that, that will yell insults at you or be kind of mean-spirited. And maybe that ruins kickers mentally. That could be the case. I do want to point out, and I'll find the article, the source to cite in the show notes for this, but Daniel Carlson and his problems here, he attributes to a kicking specialist he worked with between his final college game and his first NFL game that changed something in his technique where he would take an extra step coming toward the kick, and when you have that extra step, it's a lot harder to control everything, so your movement is a little more variable and you'd push kicks left and right. So it's not necessarily Mike Prefer's fault that he kind of failed when he came out of the draft and into the NFL. However, I think as a special teams coordinator and a guy who's supposed to be the expert, shouldn't you notice something like that? I mean, it was no secret that Daniel Carlson was, you know, struggling through the preseason. He had a worse preseason than Kai Forbath, and they cut Kai Forbath anyways, which is a decision I disagreed with vehemently at the time. But I think it's reasonable to expect your special teams coordinator, you know, the guy who is in charge of monitoring and tweaking and, you know, really cultivating the technique, especially of a young rookie player, of like noticing that something was wrong and being able to diagnose that problem. So hopefully, if they focus on the kicking game with the new special teams coordinator, and then that person can decide whether or not they want to stick with Dan Bailey or whatever's left of him, or, you know, try to acquire a new kicker somehow, hopefully they, you know, really put an emphasis on making sure they do that correctly, and maybe they can get that whole situation sorted out. But I think beyond the kicking game, you know, his legacy is going to be defined here by his work with the return units, right? Marcus Sherrill's one of the better returners to grace the Vikings in their history. Cordarrelle Patterson, maybe one of the best in the entire history of the NFL. I know his current special teams coordinator, George Stewart, former wide receivers coach when he was here in Minnesota, he said as much, and people don't necessarily disagree. You know, the Devin Hesters and the Josh Cribbs mostly made their hay on punts. So as in terms of kickoffs, there's not really a lot of examples of people to contest with Cordarrelle Patterson. And also in the punt game, in the same kind of conservative mold, he really favored punters that would hang the ball up for very long, and you want to just take the punt return out of the game rather than a punter who would kick it very deep and then require the coverage unit to make a play. And if they don't make a play, you know, you give them enough room to like possibly return it for a touchdown. That is what Matt Weil was actually really good at this year. And there was a lot of talk, you know, when Chris Cluey was first going public after leaving the team and talking about his time there, talked a lot about how, no, that's just, you know, people always said that he was a bad punter because he wouldn't kick it very far, but he kicked it very high, and that's what the coaches wanted. That was Prefer. So I think, you know, in the future, I don't think the strategy on special teams is going to change, but we'll still, regardless, we'll monitor the situation as the new special teams coordinator search goes on throughout the week. But for now, we are going to stop and take a break, and then we will come back and talk a little bit more about the divisional games. I will see y'all in a minute. And welcome back. So, the best weekend of playoff football happened, and it was kind of a snooze fest. It was three total blowouts and one game that went down to the wire at the very end, but let's talk about one of those blowouts first. A snow-filled game at Arrowhead Stadium where the Chiefs absolutely undressed the Indianapolis Colts. And this is a team that I talked up a lot in the preview, but ultimately I said, you know, listen, the Chiefs are very good. They don't have an answer to Travis Kelce. And as good as the Colts are, and as many of their players that are like outperforming their reputations, I just don't think it's enough to go win on the road with a bye. And as we saw all week, all four of the teams at home with that bye and that huge advantage won. And this is kind of a fixture in the NFL. We have not seen, there was a great tweet by Justice Mosqueda who looked since Flacco in 2012, we have not seen a team play both in a road playoff game and in the Super Bowl. That is utterly insane. But it really speaks to just how many advantages you get, because it's not only the bye, it's home field advantage, And because, you know, by nature of the 1 and 2 seed, that generally implies that you're the better team anyways. That's a lot of factors for a road team to overcome, go into their house when they're coming off a bye and beat a team that's better than you in the first place. And it just hasn't happened very often. But diving further into this one, you know, the Colts have a really expensive offensive line when it comes to draft capital. I think they have 3 first rounders and a second rounder logged into there. I don't know, at me if I'm wrong, but I think it's 3 first rounders in Quentin Nelson, Ryan Kelly, and I believe Anthony Costanzo, and 1 Braden Smith. And those guys have been really the lifeblood of the Colts. They've been able to open up running lanes for Marlon Mack and company. They've been able to keep Andrew Luck protected. T.Y. Hilton he didn't practice all week, and he was playing with an injury, and he was, you know, not nearly as much of a dominant force as he had been in the past. And really, it just took a long time for the Colts to get running because that expensive offensive line was getting dominated by a really, really good Chiefs offensive line. You know, going into the game, I thought that would kind of be a wash. I thought those two, you know, Chris Jones and Dee Ford and Justin Houston, I thought they would kind of cancel out with the good Colts offensive linemen, and that I was definitely wrong about. The Chiefs dominated them. They went into a very, very tough matchup, and they dominated good players, and they had home field advantage, which they will have next week again because they're the 1 seed. But really, really props to the Chiefs defensive line for putting Luck under all that pressure and forcing Luck to not have a very good game. The biggest culprit of this whole pressure element was Braden Smith, who allowed 6 pressures, which is pretty bad in a game. And Dee Ford was usually the one lining up opposite him getting those pressures, and he had a really, really monster day. But I also want to turn some of my attention to the Chiefs secondary, specifically Charavius Ward, who ended up on being like the best answer, I guess, to T.Y. Hilton, only giving up 1 target, had a very good PFF grade in coverage, and I think that had a really big impact on the game that Andrew Luck had, right? Take away his best weapon and things are going to get a lot harder for him, not to mention your right tackle is getting his butt worked. It's going to be a really tough game for Andrew Luck. Now, we know Andrew Luck is a pretty good quarterback, right? And we saw him play an unbelievable game last week, so I don't think that this game should, like, define his season, and I still think he's going to get comeback player of the year. But it stands to reason that he had a really, really rough day, and opposite him, you know, the newcomer, Pat Mahomes, had an amazing day, something we're getting pretty used to seeing out of him. Interestingly, he only attempted 5 passes that were deeper than 20 yards, and none of them were complete, but that didn't end up mattering because he completed, like, 20 or 25 intermediate passes over the middle of the field that ended up being, like, the lion's share of his yardage. And that kind of makes sense. You know, as good as Darius Leonard has been for the Colts, and they were also missing Malik Hooker for this game, that is has a huge impact, but they don't really have a player that can handle Travis Kelce, and they can't really handle the middle of the field. They have cornerbacks that were playing pretty well in Pierre Desir. Kenny Moore had been having a reasonable season, but when you get to that, like, middle of the field spot, it gets a lot harder to defend, right? And this is something that you can actually hear Xavier Rhodes talk about all the time, that he uses the boundary really well. Or when people talk about Xavier Rhodes, that's like what he does. Because if you think about it, if you are covering someone on the sideline, you can basically force them toward the boundary, and that gives the quarterback less of a window to throw, right? If you're kind of making it so that they have to be between you and the boundary, and you make that window very small, it's a lot harder for wide receivers to work. It's a little bit harder over the middle, and so I think you need, like, a safety like Hooker, or, you know, going to, like, throwback. This is where, like, someone like Brian Urlacher back in the day would be amazing. So I think it's really important, and it's something that we really saw the Chiefs showcase what they can do when you don't have that. So that's going to do it for Chiefs-Colts. And before we go into the Cowboys-Rams game, just really quick, this is cool. You can actually play this podcast without having to download or deal with any of the apps or any of the clicking. If you have a smart speaker, you can actually just say, play podcast Locked On Vikings. Play podcast is the important part. So if you just say play podcast Locked On Vikings, this will actually work for any Locked On podcast. If you're into the Locked On NFL draft or Locked On NFL, like, general 1-2, they'll all work with your smart speaker. If you just say play podcast Locked On, whatever. Okay, moving on to Cowboys Rams. So the big story of this game that comes from at least the national media is going to be the run game, right? They ran for like 270 yards or something crazy like that. And they did it with 2 different running backs. So I don't know. I take that as evidence. There's a huge kind of fight over, like, whether or not running backs matter. And it's centered around the Saquon Barkley pick at number 2 overall. Like, should they have done that? And I think this is evidence against them having done that, because you can pick a guy up off the street that'll do exactly as well as Todd Gurley, you know, given the offensive line play that the Rams got. But I think this is an interesting game. I think this, you know, looking at the Rams, this showcases what the run game can be if you're really, really good at it. And I don't think you need with the run game, I don't think you need it to like establish game theory effects or like hit them in the mouth or, you know, make them tired weirdly or anything like that. I think the point of the run game is get 270 yards with it if you can, right? Like get the production and get the explosive plays that they got and big runaway touchdowns. Like that is where the run game can be successful. And if you can build your team that way, absolutely do it. I think it's really hard to do and it takes more moving pieces. But in this case, you know, we kind of saw the Rams showcase like the potential of what a good run game can be. And on the other side of that coin, you know, we saw another position group that we're used to being very good, not unlike the Colts offensive line. In this case, it's the Cowboys linebackers and the front seven in general. Like, we're used to them being very good and very productive, and they just looked lost in that game. You know, Leighton Vander Esch, who is like a defensive rookie of the year, in general candidate, Jalen Smith, who really looks like his, you know, former like pre-bowl game injury self, and Sean Lee, who has been a fixture there for forever. You know, healthy Sean Lee, they're supposed to be unstoppable when they have healthy Sean Lee. And all of those guys were really run around. And I think the youth really showed up. You know, Sean McVay saw the vulnerability there. And there was a lot of misdirection and a lot of moving around and a lot of interesting moving parts that made it difficult for the Cowboys to read what was going on. But if you pull up just the highlights, just the broadcast angle of the highlights and watch those linebackers on those big plays, they're taking forever to read it. They're taking forever. They're looking for the football and not the keys. They're looking for, you know, they're waiting for all the fakes to develop, and then by that time, you know, the play has already like built and you've lost your opportunity to go attack a gap or go try to like shoot into the backfield or whatever. They were playing very reactively instead of very proactively, and usually I think that's good, right? Usually I think you kind of have to wait and see what the offense or the other team's going to do and then do the thing that counters that, but they were taking way too long to figure that out. And speaking of taking way too long, the last thing I'm going to talk about in this game is that final drive. And you saw a kind of game management situation that we see all the time, right? One team has the ball down two scores. It was two touchdowns and you needed 1 2-point conversion. And you've got about 7 minutes left in the game and you're driving, right? Well, the Cowboys took a very, very methodical approach. They really, quote unquote, took what the defense gave them. And that's a nice cliche, but what the defense was giving them was like checkdowns over the middle for, you know, 3 or 4 yards a pop, and then you'd take 20 seconds to get to the line. And by the time they had actually scored the touchdown, they had lost like 5 of those 7 minutes, and it only took the Rams 2 first downs on the other side of it to put the game away. And you didn't even try the onside kick, which we actually talked about in last week's recap when we talked about the Seahawks-Dallas game. So I don't think they were wrong to kick it deep, because I think the onside kick is a dead art, but they were kind of doomed anyways because they were kicking it back to the other team with like 2 minutes to go. I think that this is like, if the Rams were content to give you checkdowns over the middle, that should be a pretty strong signal to you that like checkdowns over the middle are a path to losing the game. And we also saw a little bit of like difficulty from Dak Prescott seeing the field on the play with a pass interference. I could only see this because I was at the game, and I looked later and the broadcast didn't show this. There was somebody in the back of the end zone wide open begging for the football that didn't get it because Dak couldn't see that person because he was scrambling around. But he definitely had a chance where he could have thrown that pass and it would have been a free touchdown. Instead, you get a pass interference, which is fine, but it took a run play and then a second play to actually get it into the end zone. You blew another like whole minute there. We actually saw the Rams execute something that the Vikings do all the time, and that is that whole like methodical, you know, let them drive down and score but just make it take too long so the game is over. And I think that we saw it really work for the Rams. And I think if you're the Cowboys, you had to attempt some contested catches. Use Amari Cooper, who you traded a first-round pick for, you know. Try to use Ezekiel Elliott down the field instead of for, you know, a gain of 3 or 4. We definitely saw way too many tackles in bounds. And I think that's ultimately, Dallas had an opportunity to win. And they would have had to go for the 2-point conversion at the end. And just real quick on that, I think that, you know, when you're down and you need a 2-point conversion, so you're down 15, right, and you score the first touchdown, you should go for the 2-point conversion right away. And this is a huge debate, right? Should you go for it right away or should you wait till the last moment? And I think you just have to think of all the outcomes, right? Think about if you make it. It doesn't matter when you went for it, right? If you make the 2-point conversion, completely irrelevant. If you miss it, it is different, right? If you miss it and you waited till the last minute to miss it, you just lose the game outright, probably, right? Or you're going for an onside kick and now you don't, you know, you're getting the ball back with like 13 seconds if you get an onside kick, which is impossible. if you don't get it and you go for it right away with like 2 minutes to go or whatever, now you kind of understand what the stakes are. And maybe that would change your strategy, right? Like, say Dallas went for it and didn't get it in that situation. Now they know they have to onside kick right now because they have to get two scores again. Whereas if you wait till the last minute, you're just kind of dead. So I think that that is like the logic that people say when they're talking about, oh, they should have gone for two right away. An interesting game theory moment that didn't end up mattering anyways because they never got the ball back, right? But I think it's an interesting moment for us to kind of talk about as we try to figure out like optimal strategy, especially in these like very familiar situations. So that's going to do it for the Saturday games. We're going to go to another break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the Sunday games. And we are back. So let's talk about the yearly tradition we always get to see in the divisional round, which is the Patriots publicly executing somebody on national television, usually some like scrappy team that we think maybe has that like road warrior magic, and then they head to Foxborough and they just get completely lit up in the divisional. This year's victim was the Los Angeles Chargers. I almost said San Diego. The Los Angeles Chargers, who were a good team. I still maintain that they're a better team than the Patriots on paper, but we really saw Bill Belichick's experience coaching come to light, and I think we saw Anthony Lynn overthink it a little bit. And, you know, as Vikings fans, we maybe are used to watching, you know, like massive game plan errors. We saw a lot of that in 2018, and it's kind of a knock on Mike Zimmer, even though I'm a huge fan of his. But I think what Anthony Lynn did is he learned the wrong lesson from the Ravens game. You know, the Ravens, and we talked a lot about it when we were talking about that game, they run this like very unorthodox, unique strategy with Lamar Jackson that's predicated on a lot of speed and a lot of misdirection. And so the answer for the Chargers was to kind of match speed with speed and get seven defensive backs out there and go. And they came out into this game against a team that works in a far more traditional way and kept going with that strategy. And I think that's a big mistake, right? That's not the lesson that you needed to learn. You learned that you can scout by beating the Ravens the way that you did, right? You learned that, hey, we watched film, we figured out what they did, we knew how to beat it, and I'm good at that. And I think the lesson they learned instead was, hey, seven defensive backs worked. That seems good. Let's keep doing it. And I think that was very much a like results over process decision that NFL teams are often guilty of. Because what ended up happening was that the Chargers played this like very finesse game, and the Patriots were happy to let all of those yards underneath just pile up. So, you know, the Chargers would play a lot of off coverage, which means, you know, versus press coverage. That means that the cornerbacks are starting very deep, like 8-9 yards away from the wide receiver, and that makes it a lot easier for you to defend if the wide receiver is going to go deep, but it makes it very hard to defend if the wide receiver is just going to run, you know, 5 yards and get it and break inside. They can catch that ball and run for a first down. And we saw that all day long in Foxborough. We really saw the Los Angeles Chargers kind of fail to adjust when they realize, or, you know, when this was happening to them, when Tom Brady would just like be content to take a 7 yard gain every time and just dunk his way down the field. And we saw these big, long drives that are just like demoralizing for the defense. And that's how Tom Brady was able to put up 41 on a defense that was supposed to be a top 10 unit. And on the other side of the ball, you know, Phillip Rivers and company were just unable to keep up. Stephon Gilmore had an unbelievable game, particularly on Keenan Allen. And not to mention, you know, all of the running success that New England had. And this is kind of a result of the same mistake, right? They, like, backed all their defenders up, and then suddenly the box was very favorable for the Patriots, and they could run with impunity and gain a whole bunch of yards that way. So I think that, like, if you're Anthony Lynn or if you're the Chargers coaching staff, you have to take a step back after this one and say, okay, what lessons should we really learn from that Ravens game? And you can attack 2019 by saying, hey, we can actually scout teams and game plan them, even though we were like a relatively green staff. You know, we can do this. We saw a similar theme happen in the Saints-Eagles game where the Eagles were driving to maybe win the game on a last-second touchdown again against the Saints, and instead there was a tipped interception. But we saw the Saints really have a lot of their success against like very soft zones. And, you know, the Eagles defense that would just, they, I don't know if they like didn't trust their defenders to keep up with like Michael Thomas and Ted Ginn, etc., in man coverage. That's a fair assumption, honestly. Those are very good players, but they were really stuck in soft zones all the time. And I really want to look further into that game later and just look at how many long yardage situations the Saints were able to convert. You know, both Tom Brady and Drew Brees seemed to really not care if they were behind the chains at all. And I've really spent like 2 years writing and talking about, you know, the chains and how important it is to be ahead of the down and distance, success rate, and all of that stuff. And really, those two quarterbacks completely overrode that like rule of thumb where if you're behind the chains, it gets harder to play. They did not care. And it was an awesome display of quarterbacking from two future Hall of Famers, and that's really cool. And it would be cool, I know, as Vikings fans, we like hate the Saints and we don't like the Patriots and stuff, but come on, a Super Bowl between those two greats would be an amazing duel to watch. But I think on the Eagles side, you know, injuries also had an impact here. A lot of people left the game. But I think on the Eagles side, you know, they just played a lot of soft zones, and Michael Thomas is smart enough, and those receivers are all smart enough, and Breeze is certainly smart enough to find the holes in those zones and pick them apart. If I wanted to be really incendiary, I would say that tonight we saw the beginning of the death of the zone defense. If the next generation of quarterbacks is as cerebral and as adept at picking apart zones as Breeze and Brady are, or if you just want any hope of being able to defend against the Breeze and Brady's of the world moving forward, you have to just play man and hope that you're good enough to beat the wide receivers one-on-one. This is pretty good news if you're a Vikings fan, because the Vikings are primarily a press man defense. Trey Waynes is at his best when he's able to play press man. Xavier Rhodes is a little more well-rounded, but he's also an excellent press man corner. Press man is man-to-man coverage, but it just means that you line up close to the line of scrimmage and you hit the wide receiver and you try to, you know, knock them off the ball or whatever. But if that is the future and that's the strategy that's going to be in vogue and the only way for defenses to be able to contend with these high-flying offenses, it's pretty good news for the Vikings that are kind of built for that. So that is going to do it for our divisional recap episode of Locked On Vikings. The next couple episodes will be a lot more Vikings-centric, but come on, it's the playoffs. We got to talk about it. So we will continue to monitor all of the coaching decisions. Remember that you can play Locked On Vikings if you just ask your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On Vikings, and you can play it without having to touch any buttons at all. Thank you all for listening. Again, you can find me on Twitter at LukeBraunNFL. You can find the show on Twitter at Locked On Vikings, and I will see you all tomorrow. Skol!